Volume 1, Chapter 1. Lord Angelo is precise, stands at a guard with envy, scarce confesses that his blood flows, or that his appetite is more to bread than stone. Measure for measure. Scarcely had the abbey bell tolled for 5 minutes, and already was the church of the Capuchins thronged with auditors. Do not encourage the idea that the crowd was assembled either from motives of piety or thirst of information. But very few were influenced by those reasons, and in a city where superstition reigns with such despotic sway as in Madrid, to seek for true devotion would be a fruitless attempt. The audience now assembled in the Capuchin church was collected by various causes, but all of them were foreign to the ostensible motive. The women came to show themselves, the men to see the women. Some were attracted by curiosity to hear an orator so celebrated, some came because they had no better means of employing their time till the play began, some, from being assured that it would be impossible to find places in the church, and one half of Madrid was brought thither by expecting to meet the other half. The only persons truly anxious to hear the preacher were a few antiquated devotees, and half a dozen rival orators, determined to find fault with and ridicule the discourse. As to the remainder of the audience, the sermon might have been omitted altogether, certainly without their being disappointed, and very probably without their perceiving the omission. Whatever was the occasion, it is at least certain that the Capuchin church had never witnessed a more numerous assembly. Every corner was filled, every seat was occupied. The very statues which ornamented the long aisles were pressed into the service. Boys suspended themselves upon the wings of cherubims, Saint Francis and Saint Mark bore each a spectator on his shoulders, and Saint Agatha found herself under the necessity of carrying double. The consequence was, that in spite of all their hurry and expedition, our two newcomers, on entering the church, looked round in vain for places. However, the old woman continued to move forwards. In vain were exclamations of displeasure vented against her from all sides, in vain was she addressed with "I assure you, Signora, there are no places here. I beg, Signora, that you will not crowd me so intolerably!" Signora, you cannot pass this way. Bless me! How can people be so troublesome! The old woman was obstinate, and on she went. By dint of perseverance and two brawny arms she made a passage through the crowd, and managed to bustle herself into the very body of the church, at no great distance from the pulpit. Her companion had followed her with timidity and in silence, profiting by the exertions of her conductress. "Holy Virgin!" exclaimed the old woman in a tone of disappointment, while she threw a glance of inquiry round her. "Holy Virgin! What heat! What a crowd! I wonder what can be the meaning of all this. I believe we must return, there is no such thing as a seat to be had, and nobody seems kind enough to accommodate us with theirs." This broad hint attracted the notice of two cavaliers, who occupied stools on the right hand, and were leaning their backs against the seventh column from the pulpit. Both were young, and richly habited. Hearing this appeal to their politeness pronounced in a female voice, they interrupted their conversation to look at the speaker. She had thrown up her veil in order to take a clearer look round the cathedral. Her hair was red, and she squinted. The cavaliers turned round, and renewed their conversation. "By all means," replied the old woman's companion, "by all means, Leonella, let us return home immediately, the heat is excessive, and I am terrified at such a crowd." These words were pronounced in a tone of unexampled sweetness. The cavaliers again broke off their discourse, but for this time they were not contented with looking up. Both started involuntarily from their seats, and turned themselves towards the speaker. The voice came from a female, the delicacy and elegance of whose figure inspired the youths with the most lively curiosity to view the face to which it belonged. This satisfaction was denied them. Her features were hidden by a thick veil, but struggling through the crowd had deranged it sufficiently to discover a neck which for symmetry and beauty might have vied with the Medicean Venus. It was of the most dazzling whiteness, and received additional charms from being shaded by the tresses of her long fair hair, which descended in ringlets to her waist. Her figure was rather below than above the middle size, it was light and airy as that of an hamadryad. Her bosom was carefully veiled. Her dress was white, it was fastened by a blue sash, and just permitted to peep out from under it a little foot of the most delicate proportions. A chaplet of large grains hung upon her arm, and her face was covered with a veil of thick black gauze. Such was the female, to whom the youngest of the cavaliers now offered his seat, while the other thought it necessary to pay the same attention to her companion. The old lady, with many expressions of gratitude, but without much difficulty, accepted the offer, and seated herself. The young one followed her example, but made no other compliment than a simple and graceful reverence. Don Lorenzo, such was the cavalier's name, whose seat she had accepted, placed himself near her, but first he whispered a few words in his friend's ear, who immediately took the hint, and endeavor to draw off the old woman's attention from her lovely charge. "You are doubtless lately arrived at Madrid," said Lorenzo to his fair neighbor. "It is impossible that such charms should have long remained unobserved, and had not this been your first public appearance, the envy of the women and adoration of the men would have rendered you already sufficiently remarkable." He paused, in expectation of an answer. As his speech did not absolutely require one, the lady did not open her lips. After a few moments he resumed his discourse. "Am I wrong in supposing you to be a stranger to Madrid?" The lady hesitated, and at last, in so low a voice as to be scarcely intelligible, she made shift to answer, "No, Segner." "Do you intend making a stay of any length?"
"Yes, Segner. I should esteem myself fortunate, were it in my power to contribute to making your abode agreeable. I am well known at Madrid, and my family has some interest at court. If I can be of any service, you cannot honor or oblige me more than by permitting me to be of use to you." "Surely," said he to himself, "she cannot answer that by a monosyllable, now she must say something to me." Lorenzo was deceived, for the lady answered only by a bow. By this time he had discovered that his neighbor was not very conversable, but whether her silence proceeded from pride, discretion, timidity, or idiotism, he was still unable to decide. After a pause of some minutes, "It is certainly from your being a stranger," said he, "and as yet unacquainted with our customs, that you continue to wear your veil. Permit me to remove it." At the same time he advanced his hand towards the gauze, the lady raised hers to prevent him.
"I never unveil in public, Segner." "And where is the harm, I pray you?" interrupted her companion somewhat sharply. "Do not you see that the other ladies have all laid their veils aside, to do honor no doubt to the holy place in which we are? I have taken off mine already, and surely if I expose my features to general observation, you have no cause to put yourself in such a wonderful alarm. Blessed Maria! Here is a fuss and a bustle about a chit's face. Come, come, child. Uncover it, I warrant you that nobody will run away with it from you."
"Dear aunt, it is not the custom in Murcia."
"Murcia, indeed. Holy Saint Barbara, what does that signify? You are always putting me in mind of that villainous province. If it is the custom in Madrid, that is all that we ought to mind, and therefore I desire you to take off your veil immediately. Obey me this moment, Antonia, for you know that I cannot bear contradiction." Her niece was silent, but made no further opposition to Don Lorenzo's efforts, who, armed with the aunt's sanction, hastened to remove the gauze. What a seraph's head presented itself to his admiration! Yet it was rather bewitching than beautiful. It was not so lovely from regularity of features as from sweetness and sensibility of countenance. The several parts of her face considered separately, many of them were far from handsome, but when examined together, the whole was adorable. Her skin, though fair, was not entirely without freckles, her eyes were not very large, nor their lashes particularly long. But then her lips were of the most rosy freshness, her fair and undulating hair, confined by a simple riband, poured itself below her waist in a profusion of ringlets, her throat was full and beautiful in the extreme, her hand and arm were formed with the most perfect symmetry, her mild blue eyes seemed an heaven of sweetness, and the crystal in which they moved sparkled with all the brilliance of diamonds. She appeared to be scarcely 15. An arch smile, playing round her mouth, declared her to be possessed of liveliness, which excess of timidity at present repressed. She looked round her with a bashful glance, and whenever her eyes accidentally met Lorenzo's, she dropped them hastily upon her rosary. Her cheek was immediately suffused with blushes, and she began to tell her beads, though her manner evidently showed that she knew not what she was about. Lorenzo gazed upon her with mingled surprise and admiration, but the aunt thought it necessary to apologize for Antonia's mauvaise honte. "'Tis a young creature," said she, "who is totally ignorant of the world. She has been brought up in an old castle in Murcia, with no other society than her mother's, who, God help her, has no more sense, good soul, than is necessary to carry her soup to her mouth. Yet she is my own sister, both by father and mother."
"And has so little sense?" said Don Cristoval with feigned astonishment. "How very extraordinary."
"Very true, Segner, is it not strange? However, such is the fact, and yet only to see the luck of some people. A young nobleman, of the very first quality, took it into his head that Elvira had some pretensions to beauty. As to pretensions, in truth, she had always enough of them, but as to beauty, if I had only taken half the pains to set myself off, which she did. But this is neither here nor there. As I was saying, Segner, a young nobleman fell in love with her, and married her unknown to his father. Their union remained a secret near 3 years. But at last it came to the ears of the old marquis, who, as you may well suppose, was not much pleased with the intelligence.
Away he posted in all haste to Cordova, determined to seize Elvira, and send her away to some place or other, where she would never be heard of more. Holy Saint Paul! How he stormed on finding that she had escaped him, had joined her husband, and that they had embarked together for the Indies. He swore at us all, as if the evil spirit had possessed him. He threw my father into prison, as honest a painstaking shoemaker as any in Cordova, and when he went away, he had the cruelty to take from us my sister's little boy, then scarcely 2 years old, and whom in the abruptness of her flight, she had been obliged to leave behind her. I suppose, that the poor little wretch met with bitter bad treatment from him, for in a few months after, we received intelligence of his death. Why, this was a most terrible old fellow, Segnora.
Oh! Shocking!
And a man so totally devoid of taste. Why, would you believe it, Segner? When I attempted to pacify him, he cursed me for a witch, and wished that to punish the Count, my sister might become as ugly as myself. Ugly indeed. I like him for that.
Ridiculous, cried Don Cristobal. Doubtless the Count would have thought himself fortunate, had he been permitted to exchange the one sister for the other.
Oh! Christ! Segner, you are really too polite. However, I am heartily glad that the Conde was of a different way of thinking. A mighty pretty piece of business, to be sure, Elvira has made of it. After broiling and stewing in the Indies for 13 long years, her husband dies, and she returns to Spain, without an house to hide her head, or money to procure her one. This Antonia was then but an infant, and her only remaining child. She found that her father-in-law had married again, that he was irreconcilable to the Conde, and that his second wife had produced him a son, who is reported to be a very fine young man. The old Marquis refused to see my sister or her child, but sent her word that on condition of never hearing any more of her, he would assign her a small pension, and she might live in an old castle which he possessed in Murcia. This had been the favorite habitation of his eldest son, but since his flight from Spain, the old Marquis could not bear the place, but let it fall to ruin and confusion. My sister accepted the proposal, she retired to Murcia, and has remained there till within the last month.
And what brings her now to Madrid? Inquired Don Lorenzo, whom admiration of the young Antonia compelled to take a lively interest in the talkative old woman's narration.
Alas! Segner, her father-in-law being lately dead, the steward of his merchant estates has refused to pay her pension any longer. With the design of supplicating his son to renew it, she is now come to Madrid, but I doubt that she might have saved herself the trouble. You young noblemen have always enough to do with your money, and are not very often disposed to throw it away upon old women. I advised my sister to send Antonia with her petition, but she would not hear of such a thing. She is so obstinate.
Well, she will find herself the worse for not following my counsels. The girl has a good pretty face, and possibly might have done much.
Ah! Segnora, interrupted Don Cristobal, counterfeiting a passionate air, if a pretty face will do the business, why has not your sister recourse to you?
Oh! Jesus! My lord, I swear you quite overpower me with your gallantry. But I promise you that I am too well aware of the danger of such expeditions to trust myself in a young nobleman's power. No, no, I have as yet preserved my reputation without blemish or reproach, and I always knew how to keep the man at a proper distance.
Of that, Segnora, I have not the least doubt. But permit me to ask you, have you then any aversion to matrimony?
That is an home question. I cannot but confess that if an amiable cavalier was to present himself.
Here she intended to throw a tender and significant look upon Don Cristobal, but, as she unluckily happened to squint most abominably, the glance fell directly upon his companion. Lorenzo took the compliment to himself, and answered it by a profound bow.
May I inquire, said he, the name of the Marquis?
The Marquis de las Cisternas.
I know him intimately well. He is not at present in Madrid, but is expected here daily. He is one of the best of men, and if the lovely Antonia will permit me to be her advocate with him, I doubt not my being able to make a favorable report of her cause.
Antonia raised her blue eyes, and silently thanked him for the offer by a smile of inexpressible sweetness. Leonella's satisfaction was much more loud and audible. Indeed, as her niece was generally silent in her company, she thought it incumbent upon her to talk enough for both. This she managed without difficulty, for she very seldom found herself deficient in words.
Oh! Segner! She cried, you will lay our whole family under the most signal obligations. I accept your offer with all possible gratitude, and return you 1,000 thanks for the generosity of your proposal.
Antonia, why do not you speak, child? While the cavalier says all sorts of civil things to you, you sit like a statue, and never utter a syllable of thanks,
either bad, good, or indifferent.
My dear aunt, I am very sensible that.
Fie, niece. How often have I told you, that you never should interrupt a person who is speaking? When did you ever know me do such a thing? Are these your merchant manners?
Mercy on me. I shall never be able to make this girl anything like a person of good breeding.
But pray, Segner, she continued, addressing herself to Don Cristobal, inform me, why such a crowd is assembled today in this cathedral.
Can you possibly be ignorant, that Ambrosio, abbot of this monastery, pronounces a sermon in this church every Thursday? All Madrid rings with his praises. As yet he has preached but thrice, but all who have heard him are so delighted with his eloquence, that it is as difficult to obtain a place at church, as at the first representation of a new comedy. His fame certainly must have reached your ears.
Alas! Segner, till yesterday I never had the good fortune to see Madrid, and at Cordova we are so little informed of what is passing in the rest of the world, that the name of Ambrosio has never been mentioned in its precincts.
You will find it in everyone's mouth at Madrid. He seems to have fascinated the inhabitants, and not having attended his sermons myself, I am astonished at the enthusiasm which he has excited. The adoration paid him both by young and old, by man and woman is unexampled. The grandees load him with presents, their wives refuse to have any other confessor, and he is known through all the city by the name of the Man of Holiness.
Undoubtedly, Segner, he is of noble origin.
That point still remains undecided. The late superior of the Capuchins found him while yet an infant at the abbey door. All attempts to discover who had left him there were vain, and the child himself could give no account of his parents. He was educated in the monastery, where he has remained ever since. He early showed a strong inclination for study and retirement, and as soon as he was of a proper age, he pronounced his vows. No one has ever appeared to claim him, or clear up the mystery which conceals his birth, and the monks, who find their account in the favor which is shown to their establishment from respect to him, have not hesitated to publish that he is a present to them from the Virgin. In truth, the singular austerity of his life gives some countenance to the report. He is now 30 years old, every hour of which period has been passed in study, total seclusion from the world, and mortification of the flesh. Till these last 3 weeks, when he was chosen superior of the society to which he belongs, he had never been on the outside of the abbey walls. Even now he never quits them except on Thursdays, when he delivers a discourse in this cathedral which all Madrid assembles to hear. His knowledge is said to be the most profound, his eloquence the most persuasive. In the whole course of his life he has never been known to transgress a single rule of his order, the smallest stain is not to be discovered upon his character, and he is reported to be so strict an observer of chastity, that he knows not in what consists the difference of man and woman. The common people therefore esteem him to be a saint.
Does that make a saint? Inquired Antonia, bless me. Then am I one?
Holy Saint Barbara! Exclaimed Leonella, what a question!
Fie, child, fie! These are not fit subjects for young women to handle. You should not seem to remember that there is such a thing as a man in the world, and you ought to imagine everybody to be of the same sex with yourself. I should like to see you give people to understand, that you know that a man has no breasts, and no hips, and no.
Luckily for Antonia's ignorance, which her aunt's lecture would soon have dispelled, an universal murmur through the church announced the preacher's arrival. Donna Leonella rose from her seat to take a better view of him, and Antonia followed her example. He was a man of noble port and commanding presence. His stature was lofty, and his features uncommonly handsome. His nose was aquiline, his eyes large, black and sparkling, and his dark brows almost joined together. His complexion was of a deep but clear brown. Study and watching had entirely deprived his cheek of color. Tranquility reigned upon his smooth unwrinkled forehead, and content, expressed upon every feature, seemed to announce the man equally unacquainted with cares and crimes. He bowed himself with humility to the audience, still there was a certain severity in his look and manner that inspired universal awe, and few could sustain the glance of his eye at once fiery and penetrating. Such was Ambrosio, abbot of the Capuchins, and surnamed, the Man of Holiness. Antonia, while she gazed upon him eagerly, felt a pleasure fluttering in her bosom which till then had been unknown to her, and for which she in vain endeavored to account. She waited with impatience till the sermon should begin, and when at length the friar spoke, the sound of his voice seemed to penetrate into her very soul. Though no other of the spectators felt such violent sensations as did the young Antonia, yet everyone listened with interest and emotion. They who were insensible to religion's merits, were still enchanted with Ambrosio's oratory. All found their attention irresistibly attracted while he spoke, and the most profound silence reigned through the crowded aisles. Even Lorenzo could not resist the charm,
He forgot that Antonia was seated near him, and listened to the preacher with undivided attention. In language nervous, clear, and simple, the monk expatiated on the beauties of religion. He explained some abstruse parts of the sacred writings in a style that carried with it universal conviction. His voice at once distinct and deep was fraught with all the terrors of the tempest, while he inveighed against the vices of humanity, and described the punishments reserved for them in a future state. Every hearer looked back upon his past offenses, and trembled. The thunder seemed to roll, whose bolt was destined to crush him, and the abyss of eternal destruction to open before his feet. But when Ambrosio, changing his theme, spoke of the excellence of an unsullied conscience, of the glorious prospect which eternity presented to the soul untainted with reproach, and of the recompense which awaited it in the regions of everlasting glory, his auditors felt their scattered spirits insensibly return. They threw themselves with confidence upon the mercy of their judge, they hung with delight upon the consoling words of the preacher, and while his full voice swelled into melody, they were transported to those happy regions which he painted to their imaginations in colors so brilliant and glowing. The discourse was of considerable length, yet when it concluded, the audience grieved that it had not lasted longer. Though the monk had ceased to speak, enthusiastic silence still prevailed through the church, at length the charm gradually dissolving, the general admiration was expressed in audible terms. As Ambrosio descended from the pulpit, his auditors crowded round him, loaded him with blessings, threw themselves at his feet, and kissed the hem of his garment. He passed on slowly with his hands crossed devoutly upon his bosom, to the door opening into the abbey chapel, at which his monks waited to receive him. He ascended the steps, and then turning towards his followers, addressed to them a few words of gratitude and exhortation. While he spoke, his rosary, composed of large grains of amber, fell from his hand, and dropped among the surrounding multitude. It was seized eagerly, and immediately divided amidst the spectators. Whoever became possessor of a bead, preserved it as a sacred relic, and had it been the chaplet of thrice-blessed Saint Francis himself, it could not have been disputed with greater vivacity. The abbot, smiling at their eagerness, pronounced his benediction, and quitted the church, while humility dwelt upon every feature. Dwelt she also in his heart? Antonia's eyes followed him with anxiety. As the door closed after him, it seemed to her as had she lost someone essential to her happiness. A tear stole in silence down her cheek. "He is separated from the world," said she to herself, "perhaps, I shall never see him more." As she wiped away the tear, Lorenzo observed her action. "Are you satisfied with our order?" said he, "or do you think that Madrid overrates his talents?" Antonia's heart was so filled with admiration for the monk, that she eagerly seized the opportunity of speaking of him. Besides, as she now no longer considered Lorenzo as an absolute stranger, she was less embarrassed by her excessive timidity. "Oh! He far exceeds all my expectations," answered she, "till this moment I had no idea of the powers of eloquence. But when he spoke, his voice inspired me with such interest, such esteem, I might almost say such affection for him, that I am myself astonished at the acuteness of my feelings." Lorenzo smiled at the strength of her expressions. "You are young and just entering into life," said he, "your heart, new to the world and full of warmth and sensibility, receives its first impressions with eagerness. Artless yourself, you suspect not others of deceit, and viewing the world through the medium of your own truth and innocence, you fancy all who surround you to deserve your confidence and esteem. What pity, that these gay visions must soon be dissipated. What pity, that you must soon discover the baseness of mankind, and guard against your fellow creatures as against your foes." "Alas, Segner," replied Antonia, "the misfortunes of my parents have already placed before me but too many sad examples of the perfidy of the world. Yet surely in the present instance the warmth of sympathy cannot have deceived me." "In the present instance, I allow that it has not. Ambrosio's character is perfectly without reproach, and a man who has passed the whole of his life within the walls of a convent cannot have found the opportunity to be guilty, even were he possessed of the inclination. But now, when, obliged by the duties of his situation, he must enter occasionally into the world, and be thrown into the way of temptation, it is now that it behoves him to show the brilliance of his virtue. The trial is dangerous, he is just at that period of life when the passions are most vigorous, unbridled, and despotic. His established reputation will mark him out to seduction as an illustrious victim, novelty will give additional charms to the allurements of pleasure, and even the talents with which nature has endowed him will contribute to his ruin, by facilitating the means of obtaining his object. Very few would return victorious from a contest so severe. Ah! Surely Ambrosio will be one of those few. Of that I have myself no doubt. By all accounts he is an exception to mankind in general, and envy would seek in vain for a blot upon his character.
Segner, you delight me by this assurance. It encourages me to indulge my prepossession in his favor, and you know not with what pain I should have repressed the sentiment.
Ah! Dearest aunt, entreat my mother to choose him for our confessor.
I entreat her? Replied Leonella, I promise you that I shall do no such thing. I do not like this same Ambrosio in the least, he has a look of severity about him that made me tremble from head to foot. Were he my confessor, I should never have the courage to avow one half of my peccadilloes, and then I should be in a rare condition. I never saw such a stern-looking mortal, and hope that I never shall see such another. His description of the devil, God bless us, almost terrified me out of my wits, and when he spoke about sinners he seemed as if he was ready to eat them.
You are right, Segnora, answered Don Cristobal, too great severity is said to be Ambrosio's only fault. Exempted himself from human failings, he is not sufficiently indulgent to those of others, and though strictly just and disinterested in his decisions, his government of the monks has already shown some proofs of his inflexibility. But the crowd is nearly dissipated, will you permit us to attend you home?
Oh! Christ! Segner, exclaimed Leonella affecting to blush, I would not suffer such a thing for the universe. If I came home attended by so gallant a cavalier, my sister is so scrupulous that she would read me an hour's lecture, and I should never hear the last of it. Besides, I rather wish you not to make your proposals just at present.
My proposals? I assure you, Segnora.
Oh! Segner, I believe that your assurances of impatience are all very true, but really I must desire a little respite. It would not be quite so delicate in me to accept your hand at first sight.
Accept my hand? As I hope to live and breathe.
Oh! Dear Segner, press me no further, if you love me. I shall consider your obedience as a proof of your affection, you shall hear from me tomorrow, and so farewell. But pray, cavaliers, may I not inquire your names?
My friends, replied Lorenzo, is the Conde d'Osorio, and mine Lorenzo de Medina.
Tis sufficient. Well, Don Lorenzo, I shall acquaint my sister with your obliging offer, and let you know the result with all expedition. Where may I send to you?
I am always to be found at the Medina Palace.
You may depend upon hearing from me.
Farewell, cavaliers.
Segner Conde, let me entreat you to moderate the excessive ardor of your passion, however, to prove to you that I am not displeased with you, and prevent your abandoning yourself to despair, receive this mark of my affection, and sometimes bestow a thought upon the absent Leonella. As she said this, she extended a lean and wrinkled hand, which her supposed admirer kissed with such sorry grace and constraint so evident, that Lorenzo with difficulty repressed his inclination to laugh. Leonella then hastened to quit the church, the lovely Antonia followed her in silence, but when she reached the porch, she turned involuntarily, and cast back her eyes towards Lorenzo. He bowed to her, as bidding her farewell, she returned the compliment, and hastily withdrew.
So, Lorenzo, said Don Cristobal as soon as they were alone, you have procured me an agreeable intrigue. To favor your designs upon Antonia, I obligingly make a few civil speeches which mean nothing to the aunt, and at the end of an hour I find myself upon the brink of matrimony. How will you reward me for having suffered so grievously for your sake? What can repay me for having kissed the leathern paw of that confounded old witch?
Giovolo. She has left such a scent upon my lips that I shall smell of garlic for this month to come. As I pass along the Prado, I shall be taken for a walking omelet, or some large onion running to seed.
I confess, my poor count, replied Lorenzo, that your service has been attended with danger, yet am I so far from supposing it be past all endurance that I shall probably solicit you to carry on your amours still further.
From that petition I conclude that the little Antonia has made some impression upon you.
I cannot express to you how much I am charmed with her. Since my father's death, my uncle the Duke de Medina, has signified to me his wishes to see me married. I have till now eluded his hints, and refused to understand them, but what I have seen this evening.
Well? What have you seen this evening?
Why surely, Don Lorenzo, you cannot be mad enough to think of making a wife out of this granddaughter of as honest a painstaking shoemaker as any in Cordova.
You forget, that she is also the granddaughter of the late Marquis de Las Cisternas, but without disputing about birth and titles, I must assure you, that I never beheld a woman so interesting as Antonia.
Very possibly, but you cannot mean to marry her?
Why not, my dear Conde? I shall have wealth enough for both of us, and you know that my uncle thinks liberally upon the subject.
From what I have seen of Raymond de las Cisternas, I am certain that he will readily acknowledge Antonia for his niece.
Her birth therefore will be no objection to my offering her my hand. I should be a villain could I think of her on any other terms than marriage, and in truth she seems possessed of every quality requisite to make me happy in a wife. Young, lovely, gentle, sensible.
Sensible?
Why, she said nothing but yes, and no. She did not say much more, I must confess, but then she always said yes, or no, in the right place.
Did she so?
Oh. You're most obedient. That is using a right lover's argument, and I dare dispute no longer with so profound a casuist. Suppose we adjourn to the comedy?
It is out of my power. I only arrived last night at Madrid, and have not yet had an opportunity of seeing my sister. You know that her convent is in the street, and I was going thither when the crowd which I saw thronging into this church excited my curiosity to know what was the matter. I shall now pursue my first intention, and probably pass the evening with my sister at the parlor grate.
Your sister in a convent, say you?
Oh. Very true, I had forgotten. And how does Don Agnes?
I am amazed, Don Lorenzo, how you could possibly think of immuring so charming a girl within the walls of a cloister.
I think of it, Don Cristobal? How can you suspect me of such barbarity?
You are conscious that she took the veil by her own desire, and that particular circumstances made her wish for a seclusion from the world. I used every means in my power to induce her to change her resolution. The endeavor was fruitless, and I lost a sister.
The luckier fellow you, I think, Lorenzo, you are a considerable gainer by that loss. If I remember right, Donna Agnes had a portion of 10,000 pistoles, half of which reverted to your lordship.
By Street Iago. I wish that I had 50 sisters in the same predicament. I should consent to losing them every soul without much heart burning.
How, Conte? Said Lorenzo in an angry voice. Do you suppose me base enough to have influenced my sister's retirement? Do you suppose that the despicable wish to make myself master of her fortune could?
Admirable. Courage, Don Lorenzo. Now the man is all in a blaze. God grant that Antonia may soften that fiery temper, or we shall certainly cut each other's throat before the month is over. However, to prevent such a tragical catastrophe for the present, I shall make a retreat, and leave you master of the field. Farewell, my knight of Mount Etna. Moderate that inflammable disposition, and remember that whenever it is necessary to make love to yonder harridan, you may reckon upon my services. He said, and darted out of the cathedral.
How wild-brained! Said Lorenzo, with so excellent an heart, what pity that he possesses so little solidity of judgment.
The night was now fast advancing. The lamps were not yet lighted. The faint beams of the rising moon scarcely could pierce through the Gothic obscurity of the church. Lorenzo found himself unable to quit the spot. The void left in his bosom by Antonia's absence, and his sister's sacrifice which Don Cristobal had just recalled to his imagination, created that melancholy of mind which accorded but too well with the religious gloom surrounding him. He was still leaning against the seventh column from the pulpit. A soft and cooling air breathed along the solitary aisles, the moonbeams darting into the church through painted windows tinged the fretted roofs and massy pillars with a thousand various tints of light and colors. Universal silence prevailed around, only interrupted by the occasional closing of doors in the adjoining abbey. The calm of the hour and solitude of the place contributed to nourish Lorenzo's disposition to melancholy. He threw himself upon a seat which stood near him, and abandoned himself to the delusions of his fancy. He thought of his union with Antonia, he thought of the obstacles which might oppose his wishes, and a thousand changing visions floated before his fancy, sad 'tis true, but not unpleasing. Sleep insensibly stole over him, and the tranquil solemnity of his mind when awake for a while continued to influence his slumbers. He still fancied himself to be in the Church of the Capuchins, but it was no longer dark and solitary. Multitudes of silver lamps shed splendor from the vaulted roof, accompanied by the captivating chant of distant choristers, the organ's melody swelled through the church, the altar seemed decorated as for some distinguished feast, it was surrounded by a brilliant company, and near it stood Antonia arrayed in bridal white, and blushing with all the charms of virgin modesty. Half hoping, half fearing, Lorenzo gazed upon the scene before him. Sudden a door leading to the abbey unclosed, and he saw, attended by a long train of monks, the preacher advance to whom he had just listened with so much admiration. He drew near Antonia.
And where is the bridegroom? Said the imaginary friar.
Antonia seemed to look round the church with anxiety. Involuntarily the youth advanced a few steps from his concealment. She saw him, the blush of pleasure glowed upon her cheek, with a graceful motion of her hand she beckoned to him to advance. He disobeyed not the command, he flew towards her, and threw himself at her feet. She retreated for a moment, then gazing upon him with unutterable delight,
Yes. She exclaimed, my bridegroom. My destined bridegroom. She said, and hastened to throw herself into his arms, but before he had time to receive her, an unknown rushed between them. His form was gigantic, his complexion was swarthy, his eyes fierce and terrible, his mouth breathed out volumes of fire, and on his forehead was written in legible characters pride. Lust. Inhumanity. Antonia shrieked. The monster clasped her in his arms, and springing with her upon the altar, tortured her with his odious caresses. She endeavored in vain to escape from his embrace. Lorenzo flew to her succor, but ere he had time to reach her, a loud burst of thunder was heard. Instantly the cathedral seemed crumbling into pieces, the monks betook themselves to flight, shrieking fearfully, the lamps were extinguished, the altar sank down, and in its place appeared an abyss vomiting forth clouds of flame. Uttering a loud and terrible cry, the monster plunged into the gulf, and in his fall attempted to drag Antonia with him. He strove in vain. Animated by supernatural powers, she disengaged herself from his embrace, but her white robe was left in his possession. Instantly a wing of brilliant splendor spread itself from either of Antonia's arms. She darted upwards, and while ascending cried to Lorenzo. Friend! We shall meet above! At the same moment the roof of the cathedral opened, harmonious voices pealed along the vaults, and the glory into which Antonia was received was composed of rays of such dazzling brightness, that Lorenzo was unable to sustain the gaze. His sight failed, and he sank upon the ground. When he woke, he found himself extended upon the pavement of the church, it was illuminated, and the chant of hymn sounded from a distance. For a while Lorenzo could not persuade himself that what he had just witnessed had been a dream, so strong an impression had it made upon his fancy. A little recollection convinced him of its fallacy, the lamps had been lighted during his sleep, and the music which he heard was occasioned by the monks, who were celebrating their vespers in the abbey chapel. Lorenzo rose, and prepared to bend his steps towards his sister's convent. His mind fully occupied by the singularity of his dream, he already drew near the porch, when his attention was attracted by perceiving a shadow moving upon the opposite wall. He looked curiously round, and soon descried a man wrapped up in his cloak, who seemed carefully examining whether his actions were observed. Very few people are exempt from the influence of curiosity. The unknown seemed anxious to conceal his business in the cathedral, and it was this very circumstance, which made Lorenzo wish to discover what he was about. Our hero was conscious that he had no right to pry into the secrets of this unknown cavalier. I will go, said Lorenzo. And Lorenzo stayed, where he was. The shadow thrown by the column, effectually concealed him from the stranger, who continued to advance with caution. At length he drew a letter from beneath his cloak, and hastily placed it beneath a colossal statue of Saint Francis. Then retiring with precipitation, he concealed himself in a part of the church at a considerable distance from that in which the image stood. So, said Lorenzo to himself, this is only some foolish love affair. I believe, I may as well be gone, for I can do no good in it. In truth, till that moment it never came into his head that he could do any good in it, but he thought it necessary to make some little excuse to himself for having indulged his curiosity. He now made a second attempt to retire from the church, for this time he gained the porch without meeting with any impediment, but it was destined that he should pay it another visit that night. As he descended the steps leading into the street, a cavalier rushed against him with such violence, that both were nearly overturned by the concussion. Lorenzo put his hand to his sword. How now, Segner? Said he, what mean you by this rudeness? Ha! Is it you, Medina? Replied the newcomer, whom Lorenzo by his voice now recognized for Don Cristobal, you are the luckiest fellow in the universe, not to have left the church before my return. In. My dear lad. They will be here immediately. Who will be here? The old hen and all her pretty little chickens. In, I say, and then you shall know the whole history. Lorenzo followed him into the cathedral, and they concealed themselves behind the statue of Saint Francis. And now, said our hero, may I take the liberty of asking, what is the meaning of all this haste and rapture? Oh! Lorenzo, we shall see such a glorious sight. The prioress of St. Clare and her whole train of nuns are coming hither. You are to know, that the pious Father Ambrosio, the Lord reward him for it, will upon no account move out of his own precincts, it being absolutely necessary for every fashionable convent to have him for its confessor. The nuns are in consequence obliged to visit him at the abbey, since when the mountain will not come to Mahomet, Mahomet must needs go to the mountain. Now the prioress of St. Clare, the better to escape the gaze of such impure eyes as belong to yourself and your humble servant, thinks proper to bring her holy flock to confession in the dusk, she is to be admitted into the abbey chapel by yon private door. The porteress of St. Clair, who is a worthy old soul and a particular friend of mine, has just assured me of their being here in a few moments. There is news for you, you rogue. We shall see some of the prettiest faces in Madrid. In truth, Cristobal, we shall do no such thing. The nuns are always veiled.
No. No. I know better. On entering a place of worship, they ever take off their veils from respect to the saint to whom 'tis dedicated. But hark! They are coming.
Silence, silence. Observe, and be convinced.
Good. Said Lorenzo to himself, I may possibly discover to whom the vows are addressed of this mysterious stranger. Scarcely had Don Cristobal ceased to speak, when the Domina of St. Clair appeared, followed by a long procession of nuns. Each upon entering the church took off her veil. The prioress crossed her hands upon her bosom, and made a profound reverence as she passed the statue of St. Francis, the patron of this cathedral. The nuns followed her example, and several moved onwards without having satisfied Lorenzo's curiosity. He almost began to despair of seeing the mystery cleared up, when in paying her respects to St. Francis, one of the nuns happened to drop her rosary. As she stooped to pick it up, the light flashed full upon her face. At the same moment she dexterously removed the letter from beneath the image, placed it in her bosom, and hastened to resume her rank in the procession.
Ha! Said Cristobal in a low voice, here we have some little intrigue, no doubt.
Agnes, by heaven! Cried Lorenzo.
What, your sister?
Giovello.
Then somebody, I suppose, will have to pay for our peeping.
And shall pay for it without delay, replied the incensed brother. The pious procession had now entered the abbey, the door was already closed upon it. The unknown immediately quitted his concealment and hastened to leave the church. Ere he could effect his intention, he descried Medina stationed in his passage. The stranger hastily retreated, and drew his hat over his eyes.
Attempt not to fly me! Exclaimed Lorenzo, I will know who you are, and what were the contents of that letter.
Of that letter? Repeated the unknown. And by what title do you ask the question?
By a title of which I am now ashamed, but it becomes not you to question me. Either reply circumstantially to my demands, or answer me with your sword.
The latter method will be the shortest, rejoined the other, drawing his rapier.
Come on, Segner Bravo. I am ready.
Burning with rage, Lorenzo hastened to the attack. The antagonists had already exchanged several passes before Cristobal, who at that moment had more sense than either of them, could throw himself between their weapons.
Hold! Hold! Medina! He exclaimed. Remember the consequences of shedding blood on consecrated ground.
The stranger immediately dropped his sword.
Medina? He cried, Great God, is it possible?
Lorenzo, have you quite forgotten Raymond de las Cisternas?
Lorenzo's astonishment increased with every succeeding moment. Raymond advanced towards him, but with a look of suspicion he drew back his hand, which the other was preparing to take.
You hear, Marquis? What is the meaning of all this? You engaged in a clandestine correspondence with my sister, whose affections have ever been, and still are mine. But this is no fit place for an explanation. Accompany me to my hotel, and you shall know everything.
Who is that with you?
One whom I believe you to have seen before, replied Don Cristobal, though probably not at church.
The Conde de Osorio?
Exactly so, Marquis.
I have no objection to entrusting you with my secret, for I am sure that I may depend upon your silence.
Then your opinion of me is better than my own, and therefore I must beg leave to decline your confidence.
Do you go your own way, and I shall go mine.
Marquis, where are you to be found?
As usual, at the Hotel de las Cisternas, but remember, that I am incognito, and that if you wish to see me, you must ask for Alfonso de Alvarado.
Good. Good.
Farewell, cavaliers. Said Don Cristobal. And instantly departed.
You, Marquis, said Lorenzo in the accent of surprise, you, Alfonso de Alvarado?
Even so, Lorenzo, but unless you have already heard my story from your sister, I have much to relate that will astonish you.
Follow me, therefore, to my hotel without delay.
At this moment the porter of the Capuchins entered the cathedral to lock up the doors for the night. The two noblemen instantly withdrew, and hastened with all speed to the Palace de las Cisternas.
Well, Antonia, said the aunt, as soon as she had quitted the church, what think you of our gallants?
Don Lorenzo really seems a very obliging good sort of young man, he paid you some attention, and nobody knows what may come of it.
But as to Don Cristobal,
I protest to you, he is the very phoenix of politeness. So gallant. So well-bred. So sensible, and so pathetic. Well. If ever man can prevail upon me to break my vow never to marry, it will be that Don Cristobal. You see, niece, that everything turns out exactly as I told you, the very moment that I produced myself in Madrid, I knew that I should be surrounded by admirers. When I took off my veil, did you see, Antonia, what an effect the action had upon the Conde? And when I presented him my hand, did you observe the air of passion with which he kissed it? If ever I witnessed real love, I then saw it impressed upon Don Cristobal's countenance. Now Antonia had observed the air with which Don Cristobal had kissed this same hand, but as she drew conclusions from it somewhat different from her aunt's, she was wise enough to hold her tongue. As this is the only instance known of a woman's ever having done so, it was judged worthy to be recorded here. The old lady continued her discourse to Antonia in the same strain, till they gained the street in which was their lodging. Here a crowd collected before their door permitted them not to approach it, and placing themselves on the opposite side of the street, they endeavored to make out what had drawn all these people together. After some minutes the crowd formed itself into a circle, and now Antonia perceived in the midst of it a woman of extraordinary height, who whirled herself repeatedly round and round, using all sorts of extravagant gestures. Her dress was composed of shreds of various colored silks and linens fantastically arranged, yet not entirely without taste. Her head was covered with a kind of turban, ornamented with vine leaves and wild flowers. She seemed much sunburned, and her complexion was of a deep olive, her eyes looked fiery and strange, and in her hand she bore a long black rod, with which she at intervals traced a variety of singular figures upon the ground, round about which she danced in all the eccentric attitudes of folly and delirium. Suddenly she broke off her dance, whirled herself round thrice with rapidity, and after a moment's pause she sang the following ballad. The Gypsy's Song. Come, cross my hand. My art surpasses all that did ever mortal know. Come, maidens, come. My magic glasses your future husband's form can show. For 'tis to me the power is given unclose the book of fate to see, to read the fixed resolves of heaven, and dive into futurity. I guide the pale moon's silver wagon, the winds in magic bonds I hold, I charm to sleep the crimson dragon, who loves to watch o'er buried gold. Fenced round with spells, unheard I venture their Sabbath strange where witches keep, fearless the sorcerer circle enter, and woundless tread on snakes asleep. Lo! Here are charms of mighty power. This makes secure an husband's truth and this composed at midnight hour will force to love the coldest youth. If any maid too much has granted, her loss this falter will repair, this blooms a cheek where red is wanted, and this will make a brown girl fair. Then silent here, while I discover what I in fortune's mirror view, and each, when many a year is over, shall own the gypsy's sayings true. Dear aunt, said Antonia when the stranger had finished, is she not mad? Mad? Not she, child, she is only wicked. She is a gypsy, a sort of vagabond, whose sole occupation is to run about the country telling lies, and pilfering from those who come by their money honestly. Out upon such vermin! If I were king of Spain, every one of them should be burnt alive who was found in my dominions after the next 3 weeks. These words were pronounced so audibly that they reached the gypsy's ears. She immediately pierced through the crowd and made towards the ladies. She saluted them thrice in the Eastern fashion, and then addressed herself to Antonia. The gypsy. Lady. Gentle lady. No, I your future fate can show, give your hand, and do not fear, lady. Gentle lady. Here. Dearest aunt. Said Antonia, indulge me this once. Let me have my fortune told me. Nonsense, child. She will tell you nothing but falsehoods. No matter, let me at least hear what she has to say. Do, my dear aunt. Oblige me, I beseech you. Well, well. Antonia, since you are so bent upon the thing, here, good woman, you shall see the hands of both of us. There is money for you, and now let me hear my fortune. As she said this, she drew off her glove, and presented her hand. The gypsy looked at it for a moment, and then made this reply. The gypsy. Your fortune? You are now so old, good dame, that 'tis already told, yet for your money, in a trice I will repay you in advice. Astonished at your childish vanity, your friends all tax you with insanity, and grieve to see you use your art to catch some youthful lover's heart. Believe me, dame, when all is done, your age will still be 51, and men will rarely take an hint of love, from two gray eyes that squint. Take then my counsels, lay aside your paint and patches, lust and pride, and on the poor those sums bestow, which now are spent on useless show.
Think on your maker, not a suitor. Think on your past faults, not on future. And think time's scythe will quickly mow the few red hairs which deck your brow. The audience rang with laughter during the gypsy's address, and 51, squinting eyes, red hair, paint and patches, and see, were bandied from mouth to mouth. Leonella was almost choked with passion, and loaded her malicious advisor with the bitterest reproaches. The swarthy prophetess for some time listened to her with a contemptuous smile. At length she made her a short answer, and then turned to Antonia. The gypsy.
Peace, lady. What I said was true, and now, my lovely maid, to you, give me your hand, and let me see your future doom, and heaven's decree.
In imitation of Leonella, Antonia drew off her glove, and presented her white hand to the gypsy, who, having gazed upon it for some time with a mingled expression of pity and astonishment, pronounced her oracle in the following words.
The gypsy.
Jesus! What a palm is there! Chaste, and gentle, young and fair, perfect mind and form possessing, you would be some good man's blessing, but alas! This lion discovers, that destruction o'er you hovers, lustful man and crafty devil will combine to work your evil, and from earth by sorrows driven, soon your soul must speed to heaven. Yet your sufferings to delay, well remember what I say. When you one more virtuous see than belongs to man to be, one, whose self no crimes assailing, pities not his neighbor's failing, call the gypsy's words to mind, though he seems so good and kind, fair exteriors oft will hide hearts, that swell with lust and pride. Lovely maid, with tears I leave you. Let not my prediction grieve you, rather with submission bending calmly wait distress impending, and expect eternal bliss in a better world than this. Having said this, the gypsy again whirled herself round thrice, and then hastened out of the street with frantic gesture. The crowd followed her, and Elvira's door being now unembarrassed, Leonella entered the house out of honor with the gypsy, with her niece, and with the people, in short with everybody, but herself and her charming cavalier. The gypsy's predictions had also considerably affected Antonia, but the impression soon wore off, and in a few hours she had forgotten the adventure as totally as had it never taken place. Chapter 2. Forse sei tu gustasi una sola volta la millesima parte del gioie, che gusta ancora mato riamando, d'rest ripentita so esperando, perduto e tutto il tempo che in amar non si spondi. Tasso. Hadst thou but tasted once the thousandth part of joys, which bless the loved and loving heart, your words repentant and your sighs would prove, lost is the time which is not passed in love. The monks having attended their abbot to the door of his cell, he dismissed them with an air of conscious superiority in which humility's semblance combated with the reality of pride. He was no sooner alone, than he gave free loose to the indulgence of his vanity. When he remembered the enthusiasm which his discourse had excited, his heart swelled with rapture, and his imagination presented him with splendid visions of aggrandizement. He looked round him with exultation, and pride told him loudly that he was superior to the rest of his fellow creatures. Who, thought he, who but myself has passed the ordeal of youth, yet sees no single stain upon his conscience? Who else has subdued the violence of strong passions and an impetuous temperament, and submitted even from the dawn of life to voluntary retirement? I seek for such a man in vain. I see no one but myself possessed of such resolution. Religion cannot boast Ambrosio's equal. How powerful an effect did my discourse produce upon its auditors! How they crowded round me! How they loaded me with benedictions, and pronounced me the sole uncorrupted pillar of the church! What then now is left for me to do? Nothing, but to watch as carefully over the conduct of my brothers as I have hitherto watched over my own. Yet hold! May I not be tempted from those paths which till now I have pursued without one moment's wandering? Am I not a man, whose nature is frail, and prone to error? I must now abandon the solitude of my retreat. The fairest and noblest dames of Madrid continually present themselves at the abbey, and will use no other confessor. I must accustom my eyes to objects of temptation, and expose myself to the seduction of luxury and desire. Should I meet in that world which I am constrained to enter some lovely female, lovely, as you, Maduina? As he said this, he fixed his eyes upon a picture of the Virgin, which was suspended opposite to him. This for 2 years had been the object of his increasing wonder and adoration. He paused, and gazed upon it with delight. What beauty in that countenance! He continued after a silence of some minutes, how graceful is the turn of that head! What sweetness, yet what majesty in her divine eyes! How softly her cheek reclines upon her hand! Can the rose vie with the blush of that cheek? Can the lily rival the whiteness of that hand? Oh! If such a creature existed, and existed but for me!
Were I permitted to twine round my fingers those golden ringlets, and press with my lips the treasures of that snowy bosom? Gracious God, should I then resist the temptation? Should I not barter for a single embrace the reward of my sufferings for 30 years? Should I not abandon? Fool that I am! Whither do I suffer my admiration of this picture to hurry me? Away, impure ideas! Let me remember that woman is forever lost to me. Never was mortal formed so perfect as this picture. But even did such exist, the trial might be too mighty for a common virtue, but Ambrosio's is proof against temptation. Temptation, did I say? To me it would be none. What charms me, when ideal and considered as a superior being, would disgust me, become woman and taint it with all the failings of mortality. It is not the woman's beauty that fills me with such enthusiasm, it is the painter's skill that I admire, it is the divinity that I adore. Are not the passions dead in my bosom? Have I not freed myself from the frailty of mankind? Fear not, Ambrosio. Take confidence in the strength of your virtue. Enter boldly into a world to whose failings you are superior, reflect that you are now exempted from humanity's defects, and defy all the arts of the spirits of darkness. They shall know you for what you are. Here his reverie was interrupted by 3 soft knocks at the door of his cell. With difficulty did the abbot awake from his delirium. The knocking was repeated. "Who is there?" said Ambrosio at length. "It is only Rosario," replied a gentle voice. "Enter. Enter, my son." The door was immediately opened, and Rosario appeared with a small basket in his hand. Rosario was a young novice belonging to the monastery, who in 3 months intended to make his profession. A sort of mystery enveloped this youth which rendered him at once an object of interest and curiosity. His hatred of society, his profound melancholy, his rigid observation of the duties of his order, and his voluntary seclusion from the world at his age so unusual, attracted the notice of the whole fraternity. He seemed fearful of being recognized, and no one had ever seen his face. His head was continually muffled up in his cowl, yet such of his features as accident discovered, appeared the most beautiful and noble. Rosario was the only name by which he was known in the monastery. No one knew from whence he came, and when questioned in the subject he preserved a profound silence. A stranger, whose rich habit and magnificent equipage declared him to be of distinguished rank, had engaged the monks to receive a novice, and had deposited the necessary sums. The next day he returned with Rosario, and from that time no more had been heard of him. The youth had carefully avoided the company of the monks, he answered their civilities with sweetness, but reserve, and evidently showed that his inclination led him to solitude. To this general rule the superior was the only exception. To him he looked up with a respect approaching idolatry. He sought his company with the most attentive assiduity, and eagerly seized every means to ingratiate himself in his favor. In the abbot's society his heart seemed to be at ease, and an air of gaiety pervaded his whole manners and discourse. Ambrosio on his side did not feel less attracted towards the youth, with him alone did he lay aside his habitual severity. When he spoke to him, he insensibly assumed a tone milder than was usual to him, and no voice sounded so sweet to him as did Rosario's. He repaid the youth's attentions by instructing him in various sciences, the novice received his lessons with docility, Ambrosio was every day more charmed with the vivacity of his genius, the simplicity of his manners, and the rectitude of his heart, in short he loved him with all the affection of a father. He could not help sometimes indulging a desire secretly to see the face of his pupil, but his rule of self-denial extended even to curiosity, and prevented him from communicating his wishes to the youth. "Pardon my intrusion, father," said Rosario, while he placed his basket upon the table, "I come to you a suppliant. Hearing that a dear friend is dangerously ill, I entreat your prayers for his recovery. If supplications can prevail upon heaven to spare him, surely yours must be efficacious. Whatever depends upon me, my son, you know that you may command." "What is your friend's name?"
"Vincenzio della Ronda."
"'Tis sufficient. I will not forget him in my prayers, and may our thrice-blessed Saint Francis deign to listen to my intercession. What have you in your basket, Rosario?"
"A few of those flowers, reverend father, which I have observed to be most acceptable to you. Will you permit my arranging them in your chamber?"
"Your attentions charm me, my son." While Rosario dispersed the contents of his basket in small vases placed for that purpose in various parts of the room, the abbot thus continued the conversation. "I saw you not in the church this evening, Rosario."
"Yet I was present, father. I am too grateful for your protection to lose an opportunity of witnessing your triumph."
"Alas, Rosario, I have but little cause to triumph. The saint spoke by my mouth, to him belongs all the merit.
It seems then you are contented with my discourse?
Contented, say you?
Oh! You surpassed yourself. Never did I hear such eloquence, save once.
Here the novice heaved an involuntary sigh.
When was that once? Demanded the abbot.
When you preached upon the sudden indisposition of our late superior.
I remember it, that is more than 2 years ago.
And were you present?
I knew you not at that time, Rosario.
'Tis true, Father, and would to God. I had expired, ere I beheld that day.
What sufferings, what sorrows should I have escaped?
Sufferings at your age, Rosario?
Aye, Father, sufferings, which if known to you, would equally raise your anger and compassion.
Sufferings, which form at once the torment and pleasure of my existence. Yet in this retreat my bosom would feel tranquil, were it not for the tortures of apprehension.
O God, how cruel is a life of fear!
Father, I have given up all, I have abandoned the world and its delights forever, nothing now remains, nothing now has charms for me, but your friendship, but your affection. If I lose that, Father, oh, if I lose that, tremble at the effects of my despair.
You apprehend the loss of my friendship? How has my conduct justified this fear?
Know me better, Rosario, and think me worthy of your confidence.
What are your sufferings?
Reveal them to me, and believe that if 'tis in my power to relieve them.
Ah! 'Tis in no one's power but yours. Yet I must not let you know them. You would hate me for my avowal. You would drive me from your presence with scorn and ignominy.
My son, I conjure you. I entreat you.
For pity's sake, inquire no further.
I must not, I dare not.
Hark! The bell rings for vespers.
Father, your benediction, and I'll leave you.
As he said this, he threw himself upon his knees and received the blessing which he demanded. Then pressing the abbot's hand to his lips, he started from the ground and hastily quitted the apartment. Soon after Ambrosio descended to vespers, which were celebrated in a small chapel belonging to the abbey, filled with surprise at the singularity of the youth's behavior. Vespers being over, the monks retired to their respective cells. The abbot alone remained in the chapel to receive the nuns of St. Clair. He had not been long seated in the confessional chair before the prioress made her appearance. Each of the nuns was heard in her turn, while the others waited with the domina in the adjoining vestry. Ambrosio listened to the confessions with attention, made many exhortations, enjoined penance proportioned to each offense, and for some time everything went on as usual, till at last one of the nuns, conspicuous from the nobleness of her air and elegance of her figure, carelessly permitted a letter to fall from her bosom. She was retiring, unconscious of her loss. Ambrosio supposed it to have been written by some one of her relations, and picked it up intending to restore it to her.
"Stay, daughter," said he, "you have let fall."
At this moment, the paper being already open, his eye involuntarily read the first words. He started back with surprise. The nun had turned round on hearing his voice, she perceived her letter in his hand, and uttering a shriek of terror, flew hastily to regain it.
"Hold," said the friar in a tone of severity, "daughter, I must read this letter."
"Then I am lost," she exclaimed, clasping her hands together wildly. All color instantly faded from her face, she trembled with agitation, and was obliged to fold her arms round a pillar of the chapel to save herself from sinking upon the floor. In the meanwhile the abbot read the following lines. "All is ready for your escape, my dearest Agnes. At 12 tomorrow night I shall expect to find you at the garden door. I have obtained the key, and a few hours will suffice to place you in a secure asylum. Let no mistaken scruples induce you to reject the certain means of preserving yourself and the innocent creature whom you nourish in your bosom. Remember that you had promised to be mine, long ere you engaged yourself to the church, that your situation will soon be evident to the prying eyes of your companions, and that flight is the only means of avoiding the effects of their malevolent resentment. Farewell, my Agnes. My dear and destined wife. Fail not to be at the garden door at 12. As soon as he had finished, Ambrosio bent an eye stern and angry upon the imprudent nun. "This letter must to the prioress," said he, and passed her. His words sounded like thunder to her ears. She awoke from her torpidity only to be sensible of the dangers of her situation. She followed him hastily, and detained him by his garment.
"Stay! Oh! Stay!" she cried in the accents of despair, while she threw herself at the friar's feet, and bathed them with her tears.
"Father, compassionate my youth. Look with indulgence on a woman's weakness, and deign to conceal my frailty. The remainder of my life shall be employed in expiating this single fault, and your lenity will bring back a soul to heaven." Amazing confidence! What?
Shall St. Clair's convent become the retreat of prostitutes? Shall I suffer the Church of Christ to cherish in its bosom debauchery and shame? Unworthy wretch! Such lenity would make me your accomplice. Mercy would here be criminal. You have abandoned yourself to a seducer's lust, you have defiled the sacred habit by your impurity, and still dare you think yourself deserving my compassion? Hence, nor detain me longer. Where is the lady prioress? He added, raising his voice. Hold! Father, hold! Hear me but for one moment. Tax me not with impurity, nor think that I have erred from the warmth of temperament. Long before I took the veil, Raymond was master of my heart. He inspired me with the purest, the most irreproachable passion, and was on the point of becoming my lawful husband. An horrible adventure, and the treachery of a relation, separated us from each other. I believed him forever lost to me, and threw myself into a convent from motives of despair. Accident again united us. I could not refuse myself the melancholy pleasure of mingling my tears with his. We met nightly in the gardens of St. Clair, and in an unguarded moment I violated my vows of chastity. I shall soon become a mother, Reverend Ambrosio, take compassion on me, take compassion on the innocent being whose existence is attached to mine. If you discover my imprudence to the Domina, both of us are lost. The punishment which the laws of St. Clair assign to unfortunates like myself is most severe and cruel. Worthy, worthy father! Let not your own untainted conscience render you unfeeling towards those less able to withstand temptation. Let not mercy be the only virtue of which your heart is unsusceptible. Pity me, most reverend. Restore my letter, nor doom me to inevitable destruction. Your boldness confounds me. Shall I conceal your crime, I whom you have deceived by your feigned confession? No, daughter, no. I will render you a more essential service. I will rescue you from perdition in spite of yourself. Penance and mortification shall expiate your offense, and severity force you back to the paths of holiness. What, ho! Mother Saint Agatha! Father! By all that is sacred, by all that is most dear to you, I supplicate, I entreat. Release me. I will not hear you. Where is the Domina? Mother Saint Agatha, where are you? The door of the vestry opened, and the prioress entered the chapel, followed by her nuns. Cruel! Cruel! Exclaimed Agnes, relinquishing her hold. Wild and desperate, she threw herself upon the ground, beating her bosom and rending her veil in all the delirium of despair. The nuns gazed with astonishment upon the scene before them. The friar now presented the fatal paper to the prioress, informed her of the manner in which he had found it, and added, that it was her business to decide what penance the delinquent merited. While she perused the letter, the Domina's countenance grew inflamed with passion. What? Such a crime committed in her convent, and made known to Ambrosio, to the idol of Madrid, to the man whom she was most anxious to impress with the opinion of the strictness and regularity of her house. Words were inadequate to express her fury. She was silent, and darted upon the prostrate nun looks of menace and malignity. "Away with her to the convent," said she at length to some of her attendants. Two of the oldest nuns now approaching Agnes, raised her forcibly from the ground, and prepared to conduct her from the chapel. "What?" she exclaimed suddenly, shaking off their hold with distracted gestures, "is all hope then lost? Already do you drag me to punishment? Where are you, Raymond? Oh! Save me! Save me!" Then casting upon the abbot a frantic look, "Hear me!" she continued, "man of an hard heart. Hear me, proud, stern, and cruel. You could have saved me, you could have restored me to happiness and virtue, but would not. You are the destroyer of my soul, you are my murderer, and on you fall the curse of my death and my unborn infants. Insolent in your yet unshaken virtue, you disdain the prayers of a penitent, but God will show mercy, though you show none. And where is the merit of your boasted virtue? What temptations have you vanquished? Coward! You have fled from it, not opposed seduction. But the day of trial will arrive. Oh! Then when you yield to impetuous passions, when you feel that man is weak, and born to err, when shuddering you look back upon your crimes, and solicit with terror the mercy of your God, oh! In that fearful moment think upon me. Think upon your cruelty. Think upon Agnes, and despair of pardon." As she uttered these last words, her strength was exhausted, and she sank inanimate upon the bosom of a nun who stood near her. She was immediately conveyed from the chapel, and her companions followed her. Ambrosio had not listened to her reproaches without emotion. A secret pang at his heart made him feel that he had treated this unfortunate with too great severity. He therefore detained the prioress and ventured to pronounce some words in favor of the delinquent. "The violence of her despair," said he, "proves that at least vice is not become familiar to her.
perhaps by treating her with somewhat less rigor than is generally practiced, and mitigating in some degree the accustomed penance.
Mitigate it, father? Interrupted the lady prioress, not I, believe me. The laws of our order are strict and severe, they have fallen into disuse of late, but the crime of Agnes shows me the necessity of their revival. I go to signify my intention to the convent, and Agnes shall be the first to feel the rigor of those laws, which shall be obeyed to the very letter. Father, farewell. Thus saying, she hastened out of the chapel.
I have done my duty, said Ambrosio to himself. Still did he not feel perfectly satisfied by this reflection. To dissipate the unpleasant ideas which this scene had excited in him, upon quitting the chapel he descended into the abbey garden. In all Madrid there was no spot more beautiful or better regulated. It was laid out with the most exquisite taste. The choicest flowers adorned it in the height of luxuriance, and though artfully arranged, seemed only planted by the hand of nature. Fountains, springing from basins of white marble, cooled the air with perpetual showers, and the walls were entirely covered by jessamine, vines, and honeysuckles. The hour now added to the beauty of the scene. The full moon, ranging through a blue and cloudless sky, shed upon the trees a trembling luster, and the waters of the fountain sparkled in the silver beam. A gentle breeze breathed the fragrance of orange blossoms along the alleys, and the nightingale poured forth her melodious murmur from the shelter of an artificial wilderness. Thither the abbot bent his steps. In the bosom of this little grove stood a rustic grotto, formed in imitation of an hermitage. The walls were constructed of roots of trees, and the interstices filled up with moss and ivy. Seats of turf were placed on either side, and a natural cascade fell from the rock above. Buried in himself, the monk approached the spot. The universal calm had communicated itself to his bosom, and a voluptuous tranquility spread languor through his soul. He reached the hermitage, and was entering to repose himself, when he stopped on perceiving it to be already occupied. Extended upon one of the banks lay a man in a melancholy posture. His head was supported upon his arm, and he seemed lost in meditation. The monk drew nearer, and recognized Rosario. He watched him in silence, and entered not the hermitage. After some minutes the youth raised his eyes, and fixed them mournfully upon the opposite wall. Yes, said he with a deep and plaintive sigh, I feel all the happiness of thy situation, all the misery of my own. Happy were I, could I think like thee. Could I look like thee with disgust upon mankind, could bury myself forever in some impenetrable solitude, and forget that the world holds beings deserving to be loved. O God! What a blessing would misanthropy be to me! That is a singular thought, Rosario, said the abbot, entering the grotto. You hear, reverend father? Cried the novice. At the same time starting from his place in confusion, he drew his cowl hastily over his face. Ambrosio seated himself upon the bank, and obliged the youth to place himself by him. You must not indulge this disposition to melancholy, said he. What can possibly have made you view in so desirable a light, misanthropy, of all sentiments the most hateful? The perusal of these verses, father, which till now had escaped my observation. The brightness of the moonbeams permitted my reading them, and oh! How I envy the feelings of the writer! As he said this, he pointed to a marble tablet fixed against the opposite wall, on it were engraved the following lines. Inscription in an hermitage. Whoe'er thou art these lines now reading, think not, though from the world receding I draw my lonely days to lead in this desert drear, that with remorse a conscience bleeding hath led me here. No thought of guilt my bosom soars, free-willed I fled from courtly bowers, for well I saw in halls and towers that lust and pride, the arch-fiend's dearest darkest powers, in state preside. I saw mankind with vice encrusted, I saw that honor's sword was rusted, that few for aught but folly lusted, that he was still deceived, who trusted in love a friend, and hither came with men disgusted my life to end. In this lone cave, in garments lowly, alike a foe to noisy folly, and brow bent gloomy melancholy I wear away my life, and in my office wholly consume the day. Content and comfort bless me more in this grot, than e'er I felt before in a palace, and with thoughts still soaring to God on high, each night and morn with voice imploring this wish I sigh. Let me, O Lord, from life retire, unknown each guilty worldly fire, remorseful throb, or loose desire, and when I die, let me in this belief expire, to God I fly. Stranger, if full of youth and riot as yet no grief has marred thy quiet, thou haply throw'st a scornful eye at the hermit's prayer, but if thou hast a cause to sigh at thy fault, or care. If thou hast known false love's vexation, or hast been exiled from thy nation, or guilt affrights thy contemplation, and makes thee pine, oh! How must thou lament thy station,
and envy mine.
Were it possible, said the friar, for man to be so totally wrapped up in himself as to live in absolute seclusion from human nature, and could yet feel the contented tranquility which these lines express, I allow that the situation would be more desirable than to live in a world so pregnant with every vice and every folly. But this never can be the case. This inscription was merely placed here for the ornament of the grotto, and the sentiments in the hermit are equally imaginary. Man was born for society. However little he may be attached to the world, he never can wholly forget it, or bear to be wholly forgotten by it. Disgusted at the guilt or absurdity of mankind, the misanthrope flies from it. He resolves to become an hermit, and buries himself in the cavern of some gloomy rock. While hate inflames his bosom, possibly he may feel contented with his situation. But when his passions begin to cool, when time has mellowed his sorrows, and healed those wounds which he bore with him to his solitude, think you that content becomes his companion? Ah! No, Rosario. No longer sustained by the violence of his passions, he feels all the monotony of his way of living, and his heart becomes the prey of ennui and weariness. He looks round, and finds himself alone in the universe. The love of society revives in his bosom, and he pants to return to that world which he has abandoned. Nature loses all her charms in his eyes, no one is near him to point out her beauties, or share in his admiration of her excellence and variety. Propped upon the fragment of some rock, he gazes upon the tumbling waterfall with a vacant eye, he views without emotion the glory of the setting sun. Slowly he returns to his cell at evening, for no one there is anxious for his arrival, he has no comfort in his solitary unsavory meal, he throws himself upon his couch of moss despondent and dissatisfied, and wakes only to pass a day as joyless, as monotonous as the former.
You amaze me, father. Suppose that circumstances condemned you to solitude, would not the duties of religion and the consciousness of a life well spent communicate to your heart that calm which?
I should deceive myself, did I fancy that they could. I am convinced of the contrary, and that all my fortitude would not prevent me from yielding to melancholy and disgust. After consuming the day in study, if you knew my pleasure at meeting my brethren in the evening. After passing many a long hour in solitude. If I could express to you the joy which I feel at once more beholding a fellow creature. 'Tis in this particular that I place the principal merit of a monastic institution. It secludes man from the temptations of vice, it procures that leisure necessary for the proper service of the Supreme, it spares him the mortification of witnessing the crimes of the worldly, and yet permits him to enjoy the blessings of society. And do you, Rosario, do you envy an hermit's life? Can you be thus blind to the happiness of your situation? Reflect upon it for a moment. This abbey has become your asylum, your regularity, your gentleness, your talents have rendered you the object of universal esteem, you are secluded from the world which you profess to hate, yet you remain in possession of the benefits of society, and that a society composed of the most estimable of mankind.
Father! Father! 'Tis that which causes my torment. Happy had it been for me, had my life been passed among the vicious and abandoned. Had I never heard pronounced the name of virtue. 'Tis my unbounded adoration of religion. 'Tis my soul's exquisite sensibility of the beauty of fair and good, that loads me with shame. That hurries me to perdition. Oh! That I had never seen these abbey walls!
How, Rosario? When we last conversed, you spoke in a different tone. Is my friendship then become of such little consequence? Had you never seen these abbey walls, you never had seen me, can that really be your wish?
Had never seen you? Repeated the novice, starting from the bank, and grasping the friar's hand with a frantic air.
You? You? Would to God, that lightning had blasted them, before you ever met my eyes. Would to God, that I were never to see you more, and could forget that I had ever seen you. With these words he flew hastily from the grotto. Ambrosio remained in his former attitude, reflecting on the youth's unaccountable behavior. He was inclined to suspect the derangement of his senses, yet the general tenor of his conduct, the connection of his ideas, and calmness of his demeanor till the moment of his quitting the grotto, seemed to discountenance this conjecture. After a few minutes Rosario returned. He again seated himself upon the bank, he reclined his cheek upon one hand, and with the other wiped away the tears which trickled from his eyes at intervals. The monk looked upon him with compassion, and forbore to interrupt his meditations. Both observed for some time a profound silence. The nightingale had now taken her station upon an orange tree fronting the hermitage, and poured forth a strain the most melancholy and melodious. Rosario raised his head, and listened to her with attention.
It was thus, said he, with a deep-drawn sigh, it was thus, that during the last month of her unhappy life, my sister used to sit listening to the nightingale. Poor Matilda! She sleeps in the grave,
and her broken heart throbs no more with passion. You had a sister? You say right, that I had, alas. I have one no longer. She sunk beneath the weight of her sorrows in the very spring of life. What were those sorrows? They will not excite your pity, you know not the power of those irresistible, those fatal sentiments, to which her heart was a prey. Father, she loved unfortunately. A passion for one endowed with every virtue, for a man, oh! Rather let me say, for a divinity, proved the bane of her existence. His noble form, his spotless character, his various talents, his wisdom solid, wonderful, and glorious, might have warmed the bosom of the most insensible. My sister saw him, and dared to love though she never dared to hope. If her love was so well bestowed, what forbade her to hope the obtaining of its object? Father, before he knew her, Julian had already plighted his vows to a bride most fair, most heavenly. Yet still my sister loved, and for the husband's sake she doted upon the wife. One morning she found means to escape from our father's house, arrayed in humble weeds she offered herself as a domestic to the consort of her beloved, and was accepted. She was now continually in his presence, she strove to ingratiate herself into his favor, she succeeded. Her attentions attracted Julian's notice, the virtuous are ever grateful, and he distinguished Matilda above the rest of her companions. And did not your parents seek for her? Did they submit tamely to their loss, nor attempt to recover their wandering daughter? Ere they could find her, she discovered herself. Her love grew too violent for concealment, yet she wished not for Julian's person, she ambitioned but a share of his heart. In an unguarded moment she confessed her affection. What was the return? Doting upon his wife, and believing that a look of pity bestowed upon another was a theft from what he owed to her, he drove Matilda from his presence. He forbade her ever again appearing before him. His severity broke her heart, she returned to her father's, and in a few months after was carried to her grave. Unhappy girl! Surely her fate was too severe, and Julian was too cruel. Do you think so, father? Cried the novice with vivacity, do you think that he was cruel? Doubtless I do, and pity her most sincerely. You pity her? You pity her? Oh! Father! Father! Then pity me! The friar started, when after a moment's pause Rosario added with a faltering voice, for my sufferings are still greater. My sister had a friend, a real friend, who pitied the acuteness of her feelings, nor reproached her with her inability to repress them. I have no friend. The whole wide world cannot furnish an heart that is willing to participate in the sorrows of mine. As he uttered these words, he sobbed audibly. The friar was affected. He took Rosario's hand, and pressed it with tenderness. You have no friend, say you? What then am I? Why will you not confide in me, and what can you fear? My severity? Have I ever used it with you? The dignity of my habit? Rosario, I lay aside the monk, and bid you consider me as no other than your friend, your father. Well may I assume that title, for never did parent watch over a child more fondly than I have watched over you. From the moment in which I first beheld you, I perceived sensations in my bosom till then unknown to me, I found a delight in your society which no one else could afford, and when I witnessed the extent of your genius and information, I rejoiced as does a father in the perfections of his son. Then lay aside your fears, speak to me with openness, speak to me, Rosario, and say that you will confide in me. If my aid or my pity can alleviate your distress. Yours can. Yours only can. Ah! Father, how willingly would I unveil to you my heart. How willingly would I declare the secret which bows me down with its weight. But oh! I fear. I fear. What, my son? That you should abhor me for my weakness, that the reward of my confidence should be the loss of your esteem. How shall I reassure you? Reflect upon the whole of my past conduct, upon the paternal tenderness which I have ever shown you. Abhor you, Rosario? It is no longer in my power. To give up your society would be to deprive myself of the greatest pleasure of my life. Then reveal to me what afflicts you, and believe me while I solemnly swear. Hold! Interrupted the novice, swear, that whatever be my secret, you will not oblige me to quit the monastery till my novitiate shall expire. I promise it faithfully, and as I keep my vows to you, may Christ keep his to mankind. Now then explain this mystery, and rely upon my indulgence. I obey you. Know then. Oh! How I tremble to name the word. Listen to me with pity, revered Ambrosio. Call up every latent spark of human weakness that may teach you compassion for mine. Father! Continued he throwing himself at the friar's feet, and pressing his hand to his lips with eagerness, while agitation for a moment choked his voice, Father!
continued he in faltering accents, I am a woman. The abbot started at this unexpected avowal. Prostrate on the ground lay the famed Rosario, as if waiting in silence the decision of his judge. Astonishment on the one part, apprehension on the other, for some minutes chained them in the same attitudes, as had they been touched by the rod of some magician. At length recovering from his confusion, the monk quitted the grotto, and sped with precipitation towards the abbey. His action did not escape the suppliant. She sprang from the ground, she hastened to follow him, overtook him, threw herself in his passage, and embraced his knees. Ambrosio strove in vain to disengage himself from her grasp. "Do not fly me," she cried, "leave me not abandoned to the impulse of despair. Listen, while I excuse my imprudence, while I acknowledge my sister's story to be my own. I am Matilda, you are her beloved." If Ambrosio's surprise was great at her first avowal, upon hearing her second it exceeded all bounds. Amazed, embarrassed, and irresolute he found himself incapable of pronouncing a syllable, and remained in silence gazing upon Matilda. This gave her opportunity to continue her explanation as follows. "Think not, Ambrosio, that I come to rob your bride of your affections. No, believe me, religion alone deserves you, and far is it from Matilda's wish to draw you from the paths of virtue. What I feel for you is love, not licentiousness. I sigh to be possessor of your heart, not lust for the enjoyment of your person. Deign to listen to my vindication, a few moments will convince you that this holy retreat is not polluted by my presence, and that you may grant me your compassion without trespassing against your vows." She seated herself, Ambrosio, scarcely conscious of what he did, followed her example, and she proceeded in her discourse. "I spring from a distinguished family, my father was chief of the noble house of Villanegas. He died while I was still an infant, and left me sole heiress of his immense possessions. Young and wealthy, I was sought in marriage by the noblest youths of Madrid, but no one succeeded in gaining my affections. I had been brought up under the care of an uncle possessed of the most solid judgment and extensive erudition. He took pleasure in communicating to me some portion of his knowledge. Under his instructions my understanding acquired more strength and justness than generally falls to the lot of my sex, the ability of my preceptor being aided by natural curiosity. I not only made a considerable progress in sciences universally studied, but in others, revealed but to few, and lying under censure from the blindness of superstition. But while my guardian labored to enlarge the sphere of my knowledge, he carefully inculcated every moral precept, he relieved me from the shackles of vulgar prejudice, he pointed out the beauty of religion, he taught me to look with adoration upon the pure and virtuous, and, woe is me! I have obeyed him but too well. With such dispositions, judge whether I could observe with any other sentiment than disgust the vice, dissipation, and ignorance, which disgrace our Spanish youth. I rejected every offer with disdain. My heart remained without a master till chance conducted me to the Cathedral of the Capuchins. Oh! Surely on that day my guardian angel slumbered neglectful of his charge. Then was it that I first beheld you, you supplied the superior's place, absent from illness. You cannot but remember the lively enthusiasm which your discourse created. Oh! How I drank your words! How your eloquence seemed to steal me from myself! I scarcely dared to breathe, fearing to lose a syllable, and while you spoke, methought a radiant glory beamed round your head, and your countenance shone with the majesty of a god. I retired from the church, glowing with admiration. From that moment you became the idol of my heart, the never-changing object of my meditations. I inquired respecting you. The reports which were made me of your mode of life, of your knowledge, piety, and self-denial riveted the chains imposed on me by your eloquence. I was conscious that there was no longer a void in my heart, that I had found the man whom I had sought till then in vain. In expectation of hearing you again, every day I visited your cathedral, you remained secluded within the abbey walls, and I always withdrew, wretched and disappointed. The night was more propitious to me, for then you stood before me in my dreams, you vowed to me eternal friendship, you led me through the paths of virtue, and assisted me to support the vexations of life. The morning dispelled these pleasing visions, I woke, and found myself separated from you by barriers which appeared insurmountable. Time seemed only to increase the strength of my passion, I grew melancholy and despondent, I fled from society, and my health declined daily. At length no longer able to exist in a state of torture, I resolved to assume the disguise in which you see me. My artifice was fortunate, I was received into the monastery, and succeeded in gaining your esteem. Now then I should have felt completely happy, had not my quiet been disturbed by the fear of detection. The pleasure which I received from your society, was embittered by the idea that perhaps I should soon be deprived of it, and my heart throbbed so rapturously at obtaining the marks of your friendship,
as to convince me that I never should survive its loss. I resolved, therefore, not to leave the discovery of my sex to chance, to confess the whole to you, and throw myself entirely on your mercy and indulgence.
Ah! Ambrosio, can I have been deceived? Can you be less generous than I thought you?
I will not suspect it. You will not drive a wretch to despair. I shall still be permitted to see you, to converse with you, to adore you. Your virtues shall be my example through life, and when we expire, our bodies shall rest in the same grave. She ceased. While she spoke, a thousand opposing sentiments combated in Ambrosio's bosom. Surprise at the singularity of this adventure, confusion at her abrupt declaration, resentment at her boldness in entering the monastery, and consciousness of the austerity with which it behoved him to reply, such were the sentiments of which he was aware, but there were others also which did not obtain his notice. He perceived not, that his vanity was flattered by the praises bestowed upon his eloquence and virtue, that he felt a secret pleasure in reflecting that a young and seemingly lovely woman had for his sake abandoned the world, and sacrificed every other passion to that which he had inspired. Still less did he perceive that his heart throbbed with desire, while his hand was pressed gently by Matilda's ivory fingers. By degrees he recovered from his confusion. His ideas became less bewildered. He was immediately sensible of the extreme impropriety, should Matilda be permitted to remain in the abbey after this avowal of her sex. He assumed an air of severity, and drew away his hand. "How, lady," said he, "can you really hope for my permission to remain amongst us? Even were I to grant your request, what good could you derive from it? Think you that I ever can reply to an affection, which—" "No, father, no. I expect not to inspire you with a love like mine. I only wish for the liberty to be near you, to pass some hours of the day in your society, to obtain your compassion, your friendship and esteem. Surely my request is not unreasonable. But reflect, lady. Reflect only for a moment on the impropriety of my harboring a woman in the abbey, and that too a woman, who confesses that she loves me. It must not be. The risque of your being discovered is too great, and I will not expose myself to so dangerous a temptation."
"Temptation, say you? Forget that I am a woman, and it no longer exists. Consider me only as a friend, as an unfortunate, whose happiness, whose life depends upon your protection. Fear not lest I should ever call to your remembrance that love the most impetuous, the most unbounded, has induced me to disguise my sex, or that instigated by desires, offensive to your vows and my own honor, I should endeavor to seduce you from the path of rectitude. No, Ambrosio, learn to know me better. I love you for your virtues, lose them, and with them you lose my affections. I look upon you as a saint, prove to me that you are no more than man, and I quit you with disgust. Is it then from me that you fear temptation? From me, in whom the world's dazzling pleasures created no other sentiment than contempt? From me, whose attachment is grounded on your exemption from human frailty? Oh! Dismiss such injurious apprehensions. Think nobler of me, think nobler of yourself. I am incapable of seducing you to error, and surely your virtue is established on a basis too firm to be shaken by unwarranted desires. Ambrosio, dearest Ambrosio, drive me not from your presence, remember your promise, and authorize my stay."
"Impossible, Matilda, your interest commands me to refuse your prayer, since I tremble for you, not for myself. After vanquishing the impetuous ebullitions of youth, after passing 30 years in mortification and penance, I might safely permit your stay, nor fear your inspiring me with warmer sentiments than pity. But to yourself, remaining in the abbey can produce none but fatal consequences. You will misconstrue my every word and action, you will seize every circumstance with avidity, which encourages you to hope the return of your affection. Insensibly your passions will gain a superiority over your reason, and far from these being repressed by my presence, every moment which we pass together, will only serve to irritate and excite them. Believe me, unhappy woman. You possess my sincere compassion. I am convinced that you have hitherto acted upon the purest motives, but though you are blind to the imprudence of your conduct, in me it would be culpable not to open your eyes. I feel that duty obliges my treating you with harshness. I must reject your prayer, and remove every shadow of hope which may aid to nourish sentiments so pernicious to your repose. Matilda, you must from hence tomorrow."
"Tomorrow, Ambrosio? Tomorrow? Oh! Surely you cannot mean it. You cannot resolve on driving me to despair. You cannot have the cruelty.
You have heard my decision, and it must be obeyed. The laws of our order forbid your stay. It would be perjury to conceal that a woman is within these walls, and my vows will oblige me to declare your story to the community. You must from hence. I pity you, but can do no more." He pronounced these words in a faint and trembling voice,
then rising from his seat, he would have hastened towards the monastery. Uttering a loud shriek, Matilda followed, and detained him.
Stay yet one moment, Ambrosio. Hear me yet speak one word.
I dare not listen. Release me. You know my resolution.
But one word.
But one last word, and I have done.
Leave me. Your entreaties are in vain. You must from hence tomorrow.
Go then, barbarian. But this resource is still left me.
As she said this, she suddenly drew a poignard, she rent open her garment, and placed the weapon's point against her bosom.
Father, I will never quit these walls alive.
Hold. Hold, Matilda. What would you do?
You are determined, so am I, the moment that you leave me, I plunge this steel in my heart.
Holy Saint Francis. Matilda, have you your senses? Do you know the consequences of your action? That suicide is the greatest of crimes? That you destroy your soul? That you lose your claim to salvation? That you prepare for yourself everlasting torments?
I care not. I care not. She replied passionately, either your hand guides me to paradise, or my own dooms me to perdition.
Speak to me, Ambrosio. Tell me that you will conceal my story, that I shall remain your friend and your companion, or this poignard drinks my blood.
As she uttered these last words, she lifted her arm, and made a motion as if to stab herself. The friar's eyes followed with dread the course of the dagger. She had torn open her habit, and her bosom was half exposed. The weapon's point rested upon her left breast, and oh! That was such a breast! The moonbeams darting full upon it enabled the monk to observe its dazzling whiteness. His eye dwelt with insatiable avidity upon the beauteous orb. A sensation till then unknown filled his heart with a mixture of anxiety and delight, a raging fire shot through every limb, the blood boiled in his veins, and a thousand wild wishes bewildered his imagination.
Hold! He cried in a hurried faltering voice, I can resist no longer.
Stay, then, enchantress, stay for my destruction. He said, and rushing from the place, hastened towards the monastery, he regained his cell and threw himself upon his couch, distracted, irresolute and confused. He found it impossible for some time to arrange his ideas. The scene in which he had been engaged had excited such a variety of sentiments in his bosom, that he was incapable of deciding which was predominant. He was irresolute what conduct he ought to hold with the disturber of his repose. He was conscious that prudence, religion, and propriety necessitated his obliging her to quit the abbey, but on the other hand such powerful reasons authorized her stay that he was but too much inclined to consent to her remaining. He could not avoid being flattered by Matilda's declaration, and at reflecting that he had unconsciously vanquished an heart which had resisted the attacks of Spain's noblest cavaliers, the manner in which he had gained her affections was also the most satisfactory to his vanity. He remembered the many happy hours which he had passed in Rosario's society, and dreaded that void in his heart which parting with him would occasion. Besides all this, he considered, that as Matilda was wealthy, her favor might be of essential benefit to the abbey.
And what do I risk, said he to himself, by authorizing her stay? May I not safely credit her assertions? Will it not be easy for me to forget her sex, and still consider her as my friend and my disciple? Surely her love is as pure as she describes. Had it been the offspring of mere licentiousness, would she so long have concealed it in her own bosom? Would she not have employed some means to procure its gratification? She has done quite the contrary, she strove to keep me in ignorance of her sex, and nothing but the fear of detection, and my instances, would have compelled her to reveal the secret. She has observed the duties of religion not less strictly than myself. She has made no attempts to ruse my slumbering passions, nor has she ever conversed with me till this night on the subject of love. Had she been desirous to gain my affections, not my esteem, she would not have concealed from me her charms so carefully. At this very moment I have never seen her face, yet certainly that face must be lovely, and her person beautiful, to judge by her, by what I have seen.
As this last idea passed through his imagination, a blush spread itself over his cheek. Alarmed at the sentiments which he was indulging, he betook himself to prayer. He started from his couch, knelt before the beautiful Madonna, and entreated her assistance in stifling such culpable emotions. He then returned to his bed, and resigned himself to slumber. He awoke, heated and unrefreshed. During his sleep his inflamed imagination had presented him with none but the most voluptuous objects. Matilda stood before him in his dreams, and his eyes again dwelt upon her naked breast. She repeated her protestations of eternal love, threw her arms round his neck, and loaded him with kisses. He returned them. He clasped her passionately to his bosom, and, the vision was dissolved. Sometimes his dreams presented the image of his favorite Madonna, and he fancied that he was kneeling before her, as he offered up his vows to her, the eyes of the figure seemed to beam on him with inexpressible sweetness. He pressed his lips to hers, and found them warm. The animated form started from the canvas, embraced him affectionately, and his senses were unable to support delight so exquisite. Such were the scenes, on which his thoughts were employed while sleeping. His unsatisfied desires placed before him the most lustful and provoking images, and he rioted in joys till then unknown to him. He started from his couch, filled with confusion at the remembrance of his dreams. Scarcely was he less ashamed, when he reflected on his reasons of the former night which induced him to authorize Matilda's stay. The cloud was now dissipated which had obscured his judgment. He shuddered when he beheld his arguments blazoned in their proper colors, and found that he had been a slave to flattery, to avarice, and self-love. If in 1 hour's conversation Matilda had produced a change so remarkable in his sentiments, what had he not to dread from her remaining in the abbey? Become sensible of his danger, awakened from his dream of confidence, he resolved to insist on her departing without delay. He began to feel that he was not proof against temptation, and that however Matilda might restrain herself within the bounds of modesty, he was unable to contend with those passions, from which he falsely thought himself exempted. "Agnes! Agnes!" he exclaimed, while reflecting on his embarrassments, "I already feel thy curse." He quitted his cell, determined upon dismissing the feigned Rosario. He appeared at matins, but his thoughts were absent, and he paid them but little attention. His heart and brain were both of them filled with worldly objects, and he prayed without devotion. The service over, he descended into the garden. He bent his steps towards the same spot where, on the preceding night, he had made this embarrassing discovery. He doubted not but that Matilda would seek him there. He was not deceived. She soon entered the hermitage, and approached the monk with a timid air. After a few minutes during which both were silent, she appeared as if on the point of speaking, but the abbot, who during this time had been summoning up all his resolution, hastily interrupted her. Though still unconscious how extensive was its influence, he dreaded the melodious seduction of her voice. "Seat yourself by my side, Matilda," said he, assuming a look of firmness, though carefully avoiding the least mixture of severity. "Listen to me patiently, and believe, that in what I shall say, I am not more influenced by my own interest than by yours. Believe, that I feel for you the warmest friendship, the truest compassion, and that you cannot feel more grieved than I do, when I declare to you that we must never meet again." "Ambrosio!" she cried, in a voice at once expressive of surprise and sorrow. "Be calm, my friend. My Rosario. Still let me call you by that name so dear to me. Our separation is unavoidable. I blush to own, how sensibly it affects me, but yet it must be so. I feel myself incapable of treating you with indifference, and that very conviction obliges me to insist upon your departure. Matilda, you must stay here no longer." "Oh! Where shall I now seek for probity? Disgusted with a perfidious world, in what happy region does truth conceal herself? Father, I hoped that she resided here, I thought that your bosom had been her favorite shrine. And you too prove false? Oh God! And you too can betray me?" "Matilda." "Yes, father, yes. 'Tis with justice that I reproach you. Oh! Where are your promises? My novitiate is not expired, and yet will you compel me to quit the monastery? Can you have the heart to drive me from you? And have I not received your solemn oath to the contrary?" "I will not compel you to quit the monastery. You have received my solemn oath to the contrary. But yet when I throw myself upon your generosity, when I declare to you the embarrassments in which your presence involves me, will you not release me from that oath? Reflect upon the danger of a discovery, upon the opprobrium in which such an event would plunge me, reflect that my honor and reputation are at stake, and that my peace of mind depends on your compliance. As yet my heart is free, I shall separate from you with regret, but not with despair. Stay here, and a few weeks will sacrifice my happiness on the altar of your charms. You are but too interesting, too amiable. I should love you. I should dote on you. My bosom would become the prey of desires which honor and my profession forbid me to gratify. If I resisted them, the impetuosity of my wishes unsatisfied would drive me to madness. If I yielded to the temptation, I should sacrifice to one moment of guilty pleasure my reputation in this world, my salvation in the next. To you then I fly for defense against myself. Preserve me from losing the reward of 30 years of sufferings. Preserve me from becoming the victim of remorse. Your heart has already felt the anguish of hopeless love. Oh! Then if you really value me, spare mine that anguish. Give me back my promise, fly from these walls. Go, and you bear with you my warmest prayers for your happiness, my friendship, my esteem and admiration, stay, and you become to me the source of danger, of sufferings, of despair. Answer me, Matilda, what is your resolve? She was silent. Will you not speak, Matilda? Will you not name your choice?
Cruel. Cruel. She exclaimed, wringing her hands in agony, you know too well that you offer me no choice. You know too well that I can have no will but yours.
I was not then deceived. Matilda's generosity equals my expectations. Yes, I will prove the truth of my affection by submitting to a decree which cuts me to the very heart. Take back your promise. I will quit the monastery this very day. I have a relation, abbess of a convent in Estramadura, to her will I bend my steps, and shut my